Kitty also confided to Shure that Oppie had no sense of fun in play.
According to Kitty, he was overly fastidious. Kitty was surely right to think him maddeningly aloof and detached. He lived his emotional life introspectively. They were polar opposites. But that had always been the source of their mutual attraction. If their marriage was something less than a healthy partnership, after a decade of marriage and two children, the Oppenheimers had developed a bond of mutual dependency.
Soon after arriving in Princeton, Shure was invited to Olden Manor for a picnic. After picnicking, one of the maids brought Tony, now aged 3, down from her nap. Shure hadn't seen the child, the baby that Oppie had once asked if she wanted to adopt, since she had lived with her for 3 months at Los Alamos. She was a very lovely child, Shure said. She had Kitty's high cheekbones and very dark eyes and dark hair, but she had something of Oppie there as well. Shure watched as Tony ran over to Oppenheimer and climbed into his lap. She put her head on his chest, and he enveloped her in his arms, and he looked at me and nodded. Teary-eyed, Shure knew what he meant. It was a message between us that I was right. He did love her very much.
But there seems to have been little energy left in their lives for their parental obligations. "I think to be a child of Robert and Kitty Oppenheimer," said Robert Strunsky, a Princeton neighbor, "is to have one of the greatest handicaps in the world."
On the surface, Shure said,
he was very sweet with the children. I never saw him lose his temper. But over the years, her view of Oppenheimer changed radically.
Shure observed that Peter, aged 6, was quiet and extremely shy, and to help him socialize, she encouraged Kitty to take him to a child psychiatrist.
But after talking to Robert about it, Kitty reported that he had no confidence in the notion of subjecting his young son to a therapist, an experience Robert himself had endured and detested.
This angered Shure, who thought Oppenheimer's attitude was that of a father who could not have a son who needed help.
She eventually concluded that she didn't like him as a human being. "The more I saw of him, the more I disliked, because it ended up by my feeling that he was a terrible father." This was too harsh. Both Robert and Kitty tried to connect with their son. One day when Peter was 6 or 7 years old, Kitty helped him build an electrical toy, a square board filled with various lights, buzzers, fuses, and switches. Peter dubbed the toy his gimmick, and 2 years later he still loved to play with it. One evening in 1949, David Lilienthal was visiting the Oppenheimers and observed Kitty sitting on the floor with Peter, patiently trying to fix the gimmick. After nearly an hour, when she rose to prepare dinner in the kitchen, Robert, looking very paternal and very loving at Peter, moved over and took his place on the floor where Kitty had previously been working with this mess of wiring. As Robert sat on the floor, a cigarette dangling from his mouth, fiddling with the wires, Peter ran to the kitchen and whispered loudly to Kitty,
"Mama, is it all right to let Daddy work with the gimmick?"
Everyone laughed at the notion that the man who directed the construction of the ultimate gadget might not be qualified to fiddle with his child's electrical toy. Despite such moments of familial warmth, Robert was perhaps too distracted to be a very attentive father. Freeman Dyson once asked him if it wasn't a difficult thing for Peter and Tony to have such a problematical figure for a father. Robert replied with his usual flippancy, "Oh, it's all right for them. They have no imagination." Dyson later observed of his friend that this was a man capable of rapid and unpredictable shifts between warmth and coldness in his feelings toward those close to him. It was difficult for the children.
"To an outsider like me," Peiss later observed,
"Oppenheimer's family life looked like hell on earth. The worst of it all was that inevitably the two children had to suffer."